Today on the Sunday edition of Renewing Your Mind.
Abraham should believe God because God is eminently believable. But Abraham believed God and God counted him. He reckoned him as righteous. Not on the basis of any works that Abraham had performed, but on the basis of his faith and of his faith alone in the promise of God.
Abraham is famous for his faith. He's the paragon, a prime example in the Bible of someone who trusted God. And that faith saved Abraham. But what about us? Is that how people are saved today? Here's Dr. R.C. Sproul with a message titled, Salvation Guaranteed.
I've often said that if I were cast into prison and was only allowed to have one book at my disposal while I was incarcerated, the book that I would obviously request would be the Bible. I could spend the rest of my life in solitary confinement, studying with all of my might and all of my mind that particular book, and I wouldn't begin to exhaust the depths and the riches that are in that. But if I were told that I could not have the whole Bible, but only one book of the Bible, I've always said that the one book of the Bible I'd want would be the book of Hebrews, because in a sense, it's a synopsis of the whole Bible. All of the Old Testament message is contained in summary in the book of Hebrews, plus its New Testament fulfillment of it. But if I could only have one chapter of the Bible, as I languished in prison, that chapter would be the 15th chapter of the book of Genesis. Now, when I've said that in the past, people have looked at me somewhat askance and say, what in the world is so great about the 15th chapter of Genesis that you would want that if that were the only chapter that you could have? Well, to answer that question, I'd like to direct your attention to a brief summary of Genesis 15. Genesis 15 begins with these words, after these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, do not fear, Abram. I am a shield to you, and I am your reward, and your reward shall be great. And if ever Abraham were a bit cynical in his old age, he was at this point. For he responded to God by saying, oh, Lord God, what will you give me since I am childless and my heir, the heir of my house, is Eliezer of Damascus? Because no matter what you give me, God, the greatest ache and pain in my soul is that with all the material goods your providence has bestowed upon me, I have no children. My wife is barren. We're childless. I can't take it with me, and I can't leave it to my family. My heir is Eliezer of Damascus, a servant in my house. So what reward are you going to give me? Then behold, the word of the Lord came to him, saying, this man shall not be your heir, but one who shall come forth from your own body, he shall be your heir. Abraham, you have it wrong. Your inheritance is not going to your hired hands. Your inheritance, Abraham, is going to your son, somebody who's going to come forth from your own body, flesh of your flesh, bone of your bone, blood of your blood. Then we read that God took him outside. And he said, Abraham, look toward the heavens. Count the stars, if you are able to count them. If you've ever been to Palestine, one of the most striking dimensions of the geography and of the situation there in Palestine is the clarity of the atmosphere. you look up and really you see a star-spangled heaven. The Milky Way would look like almost a solid sheet of white. Myriads upon myriads of stars are visible to the naked eye. Abraham could have stood outside of his tent and counted without counting the same star twice to this day and not have been able to number the stars of the sky. And he said to him, "So shall your descendants be." Abraham, as many as there are stars in that sky, so shall your descendants be. You're not just going to have one child to live after you. I said I was going to make you the father of a great nation. And your descendants will be as plenteous as the stars in the sky. Verse 6 is one of the reasons why I'd like to have Genesis chapter 15 in my prison cell. "Then he believed in the Lord, and he," that is God, "reckoned it to him as righteousness." Here is the gospel, ladies and gentlemen. Here in the 15th chapter of Genesis is the most succinct capsule summation of the doctrine of justification by faith alone. Abraham believed God, and there's no merit in that. Abraham should believe God because God is eminently believable. Abraham should trust God because God is altogether trustworthy. But Abraham believed God, and God counted him, he reckoned him as righteous. Not on the basis of any works that Abraham had performed, but on the basis of his faith and of his faith alone in the promise of God. Abraham believed God. And I think it's important that we understand that what it was that pleased God was not that Abraham believed in God. The demons believe that there is a God, and they tremble. They at least have the sense to be afraid of God. But if you're sure that there's a God, and if you're scared of God, all that does is qualify you to be a demon. But they don't trust God. They don't believe God. Abraham said, "I will put my life on the line by trusting you. I believe you." And then God said to him, "I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to possess it." Abraham says to God, "Oh, Lord God, how may I know that I shall possess it?" Huh? He just got done saying, "I believe." And it's like in the New Testament, "I believe, Lord, help thou my unbelief." Now it seems that Abraham's belief is more hope. It's more wishful thinking than it is confidence to live by. Doesn't it? He said, "Lord, it's like, I believe you, I think, but it's awfully hard for me to believe that I'm going to be the father of a great nation, and it's a little tough for me to believe that my descendants are going to be more numerous than the stars in the sky and the granules of sand along the sea, because I'm an old man, and have you seen my wife? My wife has no hope of conceiving a baby. So, Lord, how can I know it? Not just hope it, not just pray for it and hang on by my fingernails. How can I know for sure?" And Abraham said it before God, "How can I know?" And it's, again, it's because of God's answer to that question that I want this book with me in jail. This is incredible. This is one of the most exciting passages in all of the Bible. And I know that as soon as you hear it, you know, you're going to be breaking out in hives. You're going to have goosebumps up and down your spine. You're going to be so excited. You'll throw your hat in the air. Listen to what he says. God said to him, bring me a 3-year-old heifer and a 3-year-old female goat and a 3-year-old ram and a turtle dove and a young pigeon. Isn't that incredible? What, what is this, the farmer in the dell? You know? Hi-o, the dairy-o. You know, they give me the heifers and the turtle doves and all of this stuff. He said, I want a heifer. Not only does it have to be a heifer, but it has to be 3 years old. I want a 3-year-old heifer, 3-year-old female goat, not a male goat, female goat, and a 3-year-old ram, a turtle dove, a young pigeon. God, I didn't want to start a farm or a menagerie. I just want to know, how can I know for sure that I'm going to have a son? But if that's what you want me to do, I'll go collect these animals. So we read that Abraham brought all of these animals to God, and he cut them in two. And he laid each half opposite the other, but he didn't cut the birds. And then the birds of prey came down upon the carcasses, and Abram drove them away. Now, when we read this as sophisticated 20th century people, we say, what kind of primitive, bizarre, obscene type of animistic religion is recorded in this text? It sounds like savagery, where these animals are brought forth, and then Abraham hacks them to pieces, cutting them asunder, tearing them in half, and then this macabre scene of setting the pieces opposite each other, sort of a pathway in between one half of the he-goat and the other half of the he-goat, one half of the 3-year-old heifer and the other half of the 3-year-old heifer. Doesn't that sound almost like witches and goblins mixing up bat's brains and lizard guts and so on to cast some kind of magical potion? Well, that's not what's going on. Something far more significant than that. The birds of prey were attracted to this holy liturgy, to disturb it, to defile it, to destroy it. And Abraham, all he was able to do was to shoo away the vultures, the buzzards that were coming. Then verse 12 said, when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram. And behold, terror and great darkness fell upon him. They don't give this narration in terms of modern clinical psychology, but is there anybody who's ever experienced what physicians call an acute anxiety attack, where this sense of terror descends upon you, making you sick in the pit of your stomach, afraid to take another step, what the saints call the experience of the dark night of the soul? So what the scriptures are describing here in Abraham's life is as the sun goes down and he's left with this scene of carnage around him, he is suddenly overcome and virtually vanquished by terror that descends upon him in his sleep. And while he was asleep in this terror, God spoke to him saying, Abram, know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed for 400 years. But then will I also judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions. And as for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace, and you shall be buried at a good old age. And then in the fourth generation, they shall return here, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete. Now I have saved the best for last. If I ever am in prison, remember the one book is the Bible. The one book of the Bible is Hebrews. The one chapter of the Bible is Genesis 15. If I'm only allowed one verse, okay? and you bring it to me, paste up in block letters so that I can hang it on the ceiling or on the wall so that I have it in front of me every waking moment in my cell. If I can only have one verse of the Bible, this is it. Genesis 15:17. Don't look at it. Let me surprise you. Sit back and enjoy it, you know. Feast upon it. This is delicious. And it came about that when the sun had set, that it was very dark. And behold, there appeared a smoking oven and a flaming torch which passed between these pieces. Can you believe it? In the midst of terror, in the midst of fear and uncertainty, suddenly in his vision of the night, Abraham sees a smoking oven, a flaming torch rise. And this torch that no human being was carrying moved and came near and came to this corridor of carnage of these animals that had been torn asunder. And in that path between the bodies that were mangled on the ground, this flaming torch, this burning oven, moved down the middle of them. So what? Right? Sproul, have you lost your mind? You know, what's the big deal? Here's the big deal. In the ancient world, when truth was at stake, and when a promise was to be made that was to be absolutely binding, sacrosanct, that promise was made and sealed in the form of a covenant. And in those days, you didn't write a covenant so much as you cut a covenant. Because when the terms of the covenant were made, beloved, and promises were uttered and declared, those promises were not absolutely binding on the persons involved in this agreement until those promises were ratified by a cutting rite. God said to Abraham, Abraham, I will be your God, you will be my people, I will make a covenant with you, and you're going to make the mark of that covenant in your body and in your son's body. I'm going to cut off the foreskin of your flesh so that in your very manhood, you will be cut. And the symbol of that cut, the purpose of the knife, will be to remind you that I have cut you off from the rest of this world that is perishing. I have set you apart. I have consecrated you. I have made you holy. And that's the blessing of which I spoke. And the sign of that blessing will be seen in this cutting rite of circumcision. But the sanctions of this covenant, Abraham, are twofold. That sign will also be a sign of the curse to anyone who breaks the terms of this covenant. And the sign of circumcision will mean to you, Abraham, and to your seed forever, that if you ever violate this agreement, that you are saying in your own body, may I be cut off from all of the blessings of God if I fail to obey him. And so every Jew who entered into the covenant with God was forced to go through this liturgy of cutting to ratify the promise. But the point, beloved, is that God did not ask his people to ratify their oath without being willing to do it himself. Now, what happened? How did God swear an oath? Meredith Klein, the Old Testament theologian that's contributed so much to modern scholarship, once wrote a book called By Oath Consigned, calling attention to the fact that at the heart of our relationship to God is the oath, is the vow, is the promise on both sides of the equation. My promise to God, God's promise to me. Now, how does God swear an oath? How does God make a promise? What does God say? Do we go to God and put a Bible in his hand and say, raise your right hand, God, and say it to me, I swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me? Huh? We don't do that. How does God take an oath? How does God swear a vow? What we've read here with this strange description of the furnace and the smoke passing through these bloody pieces is a theophany. And a theophany is one of these technical theological terms. You get the Greek word theos for God and phoneo, which means to manifest. The word theophany means a visible manifestation of the invisible God. And when God appears visibly in the Bible, his favorite way of doing it is in some form of fire. The bush that burns but is not consumed. The pillar of smoke that leads the people of Israel through the wilderness. Do you see, in Hebrew terms, what is happening in this night vision is that Abraham sees that flaming torch moving through those pieces. That flaming torch represents the very presence of God. And here God is stooping to human level. God is condescending to swear a sacred, eternal vow to his people. And the meaning of that vow, when God passes between those pieces of the animal, what God is saying to Abraham is, Abraham, do you want to know if I'm going to keep my word? Do you want to know if I'm going to keep my promise to you? Well, let me tell you what I'm going to put on the line. I am swearing by myself. There's nothing higher than myself. I can't swear by the heavens. I made the heavens. I can't swear by the earth. I made the earth. The only thing I can swear by, not the hair of my chinny chin chin, the only thing I can swear by, Abraham, is my eternal character, my immutable being. And what I am dramatizing to you in this action, Abraham, is this. If I ever fail to keep a promise to you, I am saying, may I, the immutable, eternal, self-existent being, suffer a mutation. May I, who am immortal, become mortal. May I, who cannot die, perish. I'm swearing by my deity. And I'm saying that just as you have cut these animals in half, if I ever lie to you, if I ever break a promise to you, may I be cut in half and destroyed. It is impossible for God to lie. And it is impossible for God to break a promise. For he has taken an oath. And he has sworn by himself.
Salvation is guaranteed by the promise of God himself. You're listening to Renewing Your Mind. I'm Lee Webb. Thanks for joining us on this Lord's Day edition of our program. Last Sunday, we wrapped up Dr. R.C. Sproul's verse-by-verse series from the book of Romans. And this week, we have begun what we call the Classic Collection, a compilation of 10 of Dr. Sproul's most beloved messages. We hope you'll join us each Sunday over the next several weeks as we make our way through this collection. You're also welcome to reach out and request the full series for your home library. We'll be happy to send you the 10 CD set when you contact us with a donation of any amount to Ligonier Ministries. Our web address is renewingyourmind.org. This classic collection includes messages such as, What is Truth? If God is Good, Why Do I Suffer? And All Christians Believe in Predestination. These messages are about an hour long, so they're contained on 10 CDs. We're not in the office on this Lord's Day, but you can still make your donation and request the series online by going to renewingyourmind.org. And thank you for your generosity. People around the world have access to faithful biblical teaching because of your gifts. Next Sunday, Dr. Sproul's message is titled, If There's a God, Why Are There Atheists? It's a great question, and he'll answer it next week here on Renewing Your Mind.